Yo, it's Jey Uso from WWE.
And I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer. SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting.
Than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience.
With Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win.
Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Game day at my place is kind of a big deal. If I'm grilling, chilling, and watching hoops, my outdoor patio setup better be ready to play. That's where Wayfair wins. From patio seating and umbrellas to grills and grilling accessories, Wayfair's got it all, and it shows up fast. I'm talking championship level fast and easy delivery. So level up your grill game and your outdoor chill game and head to Wayfair.com now to get your outdoor space ready for the season.
Bustin' Loose Baseball,
hosted by Grant Paulson
and Toby Altizer,
gives you in-depth analytics
and interviews on everything baseball in the nation's capital.
Now, here's your host, Grant Paulson and Toby Altizer.
All right, with that in mind, it is time for our first true mailbag episode on Bustin' Loose Baseball. We both solicited questions from you guys. We got a ton of responses, dozens and dozens of questions poured in. So we've looked over many of them. Some of them are similar and redundant, so we grabbed as many of those as we could. And we will mow through as many as we can here without this pod being so long that you look at it and decide not to listen to it here on Bustin' Loose Baseball. So we'll bring in our producer, Darius Dameron, who's got a bunch of these questions, and we'll hit as many as we can rapid fire.
How about this? A mailbag episode on Bustin' Loose Baseball. I'm excited. Let's do this, boys. So let's start with at David DC Football. He says, how likely is Ted Leonsis to buy the team? And then he tagged us in a post where it was a interview with Alex Flum from DC News Now interviewing Ted Leonsis before a Mystics game the other night. And Leonsis basically was openly saying that he wants to go back to the table with the learners and purchase the team. What do you guys think? How likely is
it? Yeah, and he said as much on the Junkies on 106.7 The Fan. Remember a couple of weeks ago, he basically came out, Darius, and said he planned on trying to buy the team again, and he thinks that, you know, that he will be able to work this out. To my knowledge, he is the only legitimate buyer who's interested right now. He's certainly the only public name we know that is still involved and wants to be in the mix. The learners, remember, here's where we are. They took the team off the market, essentially. Everybody I've talked to, it sounds silly to say my sources, but like the people that are involved in this process or know anything about it, tell me that over the next, the problem is nobody knows the timeline, but that this team will eventually be sold and that Ted Leonsis is the guy that's going to get the team almost certainly unless something changes. So I have kind of, those are the betting odds. Like he's minus 275 or 300 on the board to buy this team. The better question to me is when. You know, I've kind of penciled in this offseason that maybe they put the team back for sale. I still think they're going to want what they asked for, and I don't think Leonsis wants to pay that, and they're kind of doing a little bit of a stare down. But supposedly Ted and Mark have a really good relationship. Lerner, remember, speaking of Mark, is the guy in that ownership group that's super involved, that really likes doing this. I get the sense that some of the other members of what is a big family that makes these decisions together, you know, aren't as desperate to continue to own the team and certainly be involved day in and day out. So it's a weird situation. I guess if I was to make a prediction, this is not, you know, reporting anything, this is speculative. I think Ted will buy the team, and I would assume it would be probably, I think this offseason is certainly possible, maybe a year from now, something like that. But my guess is that Ted Leonsis owns the Nats within the next few years.
Yeah, I think with this Ted Leonsis thing, it's not really a question of who's going to be the next owner or when it's just if. Like, to me, it's whether they're going to sell it or not. And it sounds like from your sourcing and just from various reports that it's going to happen. It's just kind of now, when is it going to happen? And the only suitor we know about is Ted Leonsis. So I think it makes sense that at some point it's going to get done. Hopefully it's as soon as possible so you can kind of get things moving along. But yeah, I mean, I think at this point, from all the stuff that we've seen, it's going to happen. It's just a matter of when it actually happens.
Yeah, and just to clarify, I mean, I don't know anything specific as it pertains to like that the learners want to sell. I have just heard that in the same way that when they put the team on the market initially, you know, and they didn't really know how it was going to end, they took the team off the market the same way, not necessarily knowing if that would mean they never sold. Like, it was not done in perpetuity as much as that was the thing to do at that time. And I just think that they are ultimately going to sell. I think there's more interest in the grand scheme of the, you know, the big picture of the Lerner family in moving the team probably than keeping it, best I can tell.
Well, and the one thing we've known about the Lerners, and I'm interested to see if they would change it just to kind of move on, is they're going to set a number, and if you don't match the number or get to the number, then they're not going to make the move. So I'm interested to see if they are willing to budge at all, if Ted doesn't want to match that number. But I think Ted also knows how they do business, and if he really wants the Nats, he's going to look at the number, and he'll probably go right to the number and see if they can get a deal done.
Chris Mullins on the Twitterverse says, I would like to know you guys' Nats all-time lineup. Give me their position, their spot in the order. You can add a DH. And also want to know who you're putting on the bump and who's coming out of the pen to close the game. This is a good one.
Absolutely love it. This is fantastic. This is, Grant, this is what mailbags are made for. These sorts of questions, 100%. So what we're going to do here is I'll give you my lineup and then Darius and Grant can critique it. So I'll put them in order. I'll give you the defensive positions first. So catching, we'll go Wilson Ramos. On the bump, we got Max Scherzer. Coming out of the pen to close, the Chief, Chad Cordero. At first base, Mr. National, Ryan Zimmerman. At second base, Daniel Murphy. At shortstop, my guy, one of my favorite Nationals, Trey Turner. At third base, Tony Two Bags, Anthony Rendon. Here's where it gets a little funky if you want to argue about the criteria. We can do that. In left field, Alfonso Soriano. In center field, and I can back this up, he played over 100 games there, Bryce Harper. And in right field, the chosen one, Juan Soto.
So my quick critiques then of your alignment. Who'd you say was catching, by the way?
Wilson Ramos. Oh, by the way, DH, Adam Dunn.
Okay, so there's not a lot I dislike here. I think we've got to figure out, did Soriano, who had the amazing 40-40 season in 06, I believe it was, did Soriano play enough games to quote-unquote qualify? Like, I mean, are we throwing him on the list? I mean, it was the best season and Nats turned in, one of the top three or four for sure. So is that enough to have him? Certainly not a lifetime achievement award. Like, I would bump him and move Bryce over, because even though Bryce played enough games in center, is the idea of like what the lineup would, I guess it wouldn't be what it looks like now because some of these guys are 50. So we don't have to worry about the fact that Bryce probably can't go gap to gap in center field in his current state as a first baseman.
Yeah, let's just assume we're getting them in their prime.
You're getting prime Nationals. So, okay, so Bryce in center, no problem. Soto in right. You're going Fonsi in left, so no Jason Worth, obviously. DH and Dunn. I don't think you can argue with the third to first that you just laid out there. And you had Zim at first?
I did have Zim at first.
Over LaRoche?
Yes.
Okay, I got no problem with that. I mean, if you're going to go Rendon at third, Turner at short, then you probably have to have Zim at first.
Yeah.
And I will say this, like, it's tough because you would like LaRoche, you would like some of these guys, but you can't leave Zim off, right? Like, Zim deserves to be there. But you'll also look, and if we were to put this in an order, because he wanted us to make a lineup, this is what I got for the lineup. Turner leading off, Soto batting second, Rendon third, Harper batting cleanup, Soriano batting fifth, Dunn batting sixth at DH, Zim at seventh, Murphy at eighth, and Wilson Ramos catching batting ninth. So you look it down to the bottom there, maybe some of those guys could be exchanged. I'm interested, though, Max Scherzer has got to be the best pitcher in Nats history, but it's so difficult because it depends upon what we're talking about. If we're going into a postseason game, give me Steven Strasburg.
Definitely, but Max is the ace, no doubt. Who's your reliever?
Chad Cordero.
Chief as your closer? Yeah, I mean, I guess as I mean, he had certainly one of the most dominant seasons. I think a pen that had like a Tyler Clippard, I think Sean Doolittle's got to be in the conversation probably.
If we're doing a setup guy, Clifford's my setup guy.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think I would honestly, I think I might have Duclos. Peak of his powers, Doolittle throwing 94. Chief was really good, but I think top of the zone, elevated 94 mile an hour fastballs with spin from Doolittle. Doolittle at his best was a tough customer.
I don't disagree. It was a difficult decision. That might have been the hardest one for me, was picking the closer.
Darris, you got anybody he's leaving off the list that you want to advocate for?
So I do think I would probably choose Adam LaRoche over Adam Dunn as the DH. I think is what I'm thinking. Either if it's not that, maybe I'm swapping Zim and LaRoche and putting LaRoche at first and Zim as the DH. But something of that sort. I think Adam LaRoche deserves a little bit of a spot over Adam Dunn there. And then catching is kind of interesting. When you say best catcher in Nats history, I'm kind of wondering if Pudge Rodriguez maybe gets a look there. I don't know. It's something feels weird about including Wilson Ramos there. Considering, you know, he didn't make it to the World Series team. Not that Suzuki or Gomes probably is the best catcher in Nats history either, but I just don't know if Ramos is that either. It's tough. I guess catcher has just been one of those positions that we haven't quite nailed over the years here in as the Nationals.
Yeah, I just kind of went on longevity and a guy that was solid for years because there really wasn't a huge difference maker at catcher over the years.
Adam LaRoche, in case you're curious, in comparing him to Adam Dunn, LaRoche, 489 games as a National compared to 317 for Dunn. And for LaRoche, his OPS was 781, ops plus of 112. Dunn's OPS was 910, ops plus of 141. People sleep, man. Adam Dunn, bad dude.
That's crazy. Yeah.
He hit bombs. So he would definitely be on my list as a DH. Couple of guys that were omitted, and I'm not saying they're worthy, like Caitlin Clark style. I'm not saying someone on the team is worse than them, right? But I do just want to mention on their in their behalf, Ian Desmond would have been nice to see in that mix. If you look at like OPS all time as a National, he's high on that list. And then look, everyone knows if they listen enough, I'm not the biggest Jason Wirth guy in the world, but Jason Wirth not showing up is a little bit weird because of what he meant to the team and where he ranks all time in some counting categories. But I can't take too much issue with that.
Real quick, if we're not putting Harper in center field, we take out one of the outfielders. Say you take out Soriano and you're going with a center fielder that's played there primarily. That's their primary position. Who would you take as a center fielder? Is it Denard Span?
Jacob Young.
Love it. I love it.
That is my guy. Who would I take as my Nat center fielder? I'm a big Span guy. I do love
Span. I love Denard Span.
That was 100% my answer. If it's not Bryson center field, then yeah, it'd be Denard Span easily.
Or Victor Robles. I mean, he was.
I'm going to go with Denard Span. Respectfully.
Wait, I'm being told it's not Victor Robles. Great question. And yeah, we all could have done our own lineups, but in the interest of time, we thought we would just bust Toby's chops a little bit. All right, what's next, Darris?
So you actually just mentioned a little bit of this one here. You mentioned OPS in regards to the comparison between Adam Dunn and Adam LaRoche. So this next one comes from @Tom_Natali. He says, this isn't necessarily a Nats question, but I often hear you and Toby mention OPS on the pod. Why is that such an important stat, and why is it a good indicator for players at all levels?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's the single best way. If I only get one number given to me on a player who's a hitter, who's an offensive player, I can only get one stat to figure out what kind of year they're having. It would be OPS. Wouldn't be batting average, which is way less important. I really like on-base percentage. I think it's significant, but it's baked in. I really like slug, but it's baked in, right? So OPS, you guys know this, on-base plus slugging. The reason it's important is really dating back to, I guess, Moneyball. And this idea of, you know, what is the most important thing you can do in baseball? You know, for a while, we've kind of understood that the goal is to score runs. So you could just say, well, runs scored, you know, is the most important stat. In fact, Jacob Young on this podcast said that's the stat he cares the most about, is am I scoring runs? And a couple of years ago, when Aaron Judge broke the American League home run record, he and Jacob Young in Fredericksburg had the most runs scored in all of pro baseball. They both were like over 120 runs. But that is, runs is not something you can really control. Like, that is not a process stat, is what I would call it. It's a result stat. You can get on, but are you able to move up? Does someone sacrifice themselves and get you in a scoring position? Does someone drive you in? So that's not indicative of how you're performing all the time. So what you're looking for is a stat that is indicative of some you taking care of what you control. You getting on base and you slugging. A extra base hit is way more valuable than a single. So that's where we've gotten smarter than to say hitting for average is important. Well, to some extent, sure. But if Joey Meneses is hitting 275 with all singles and someone's hitting 240 with power and they're creating more runs and offense for you, then they're a better offensive player. So that's where the extra base hits are significant. Teams are slugging their way to the World Series every year. You see it with Philly and Houston and other teams. And getting on base is the entire name of the game. You put pitchers at stress. You're able, especially in today's day and age, to manufacture offense by stealing bases. So on base plus slugging as a entity, that number, it immediately tells you. And you got to know what the league average is, which undulates some. But we could look this up right now. The last I checked about a week ago, it was right around 615 or 620, which is actually way lower, guys, than I would have thought. But, you know, I generally say over 700 is solid. You know, over 800 is really good. Over 900 is elite. And if you're over 1,000, you're top 5 to 10 in the sport. You're you know, vying for an MVP, basically. But, yeah, that would be my long-winded answer.
Yeah, so basically OPS, like you mentioned, is on base plus slug, and it's two things that I think over the last, 15, 20 years, have grown in importance in on-base percentage and slugging percentage, because those are the two things that a lot of front offices are looking at in terms of, can you drive the baseball and are you getting on base? So, you know, that's how you get guys like a Kyle Schwarber and a Joey Gallo into lineups where they wouldn't have been in lineups in the 1990s, because their on-base percentage is high and then their slug is also high. So it's just a different style of baseball, and as baseball has evolved, where on base percentage has become more important than batting average, I'm still a little bit traditionalist. I think batting average is still important, but generally people are going to look at on base. So that obviously factors into the OPS, and then slugging percentage. What are you doing with the hits that you get? Is it something where you're just getting singles? You're going to have a lower OPS. Are you driving the ball all over the place? And you combine that with a good on-base percentage. That's how you end up with a good OPS. Just for example, if you want a Nationals example, CJ Abrams has not had a great year in terms of on-base percentage, but his slugging percentage all year has been in the 450 range. So even though he's had a bad stretch and he's had a on-base percentage right around or under 300, he's got an OPS around 750, which means that he's a really good hitter, or at least an above average hitter, because he's been hitting the ball all over the place and doubles and triples and homers. So it's just a different way to look at guys and evaluate them without going back and looking at simply batting average. And just to answer your question real quick, Grant, 699 is the average OPS this year. That's the league average. Last year it was 734. 2022 was 706. So generally, like you said, around that 700 number is about league average, give or take.
Yeah, and that actually has jumped quite a bit as the weather's warmed up the last couple of weeks. As I said, it was down way closer to 600 than 700. But to your point, we have seen OPSs as a league average. Generally, they'll end up by year's end in like the 720 to 740 range, I would say. Last year, it was right around 735, I think. We've seen it down lower than 700 a couple of times. But yeah, so anytime you're looking at numbers, you want to know what is league average. So the league average offensive player right now is hitting 240. Then most people look at a 245 batting average and they go, oh, that's a terrible batting average. Well, actually, no, it's average, right? I mean, you're thinking about this like it's 20 years ago. I mean, the average in the sport is like one of the two lowest years in the last like 50 years right now or something crazy. So I think that's something that I always bring up is, you really have to know what the league averages are. You talk about CJ slugging 450. The average slugger right now slugging 390. Now you're 60 points above average. So I think that's significant. But yeah, OPS to me is like the stat that means the most to me offensively. What's more interesting, I think, just to kind of have a fun combo, would be what is a pitching stat that's like that, like your catch-me-all stat. And I'm not taking the cop-out of like war or anything like that. Which is all in cumbersome speaking to value that you control. But I would think maybe if I could only look at one stat, like if I'm looking for stuff, I'm trying to figure out, does this guy have legit stuff? I look at strikeout rate. If you miss bats, if you get swings and misses, that's an indicator of plus elite stuff. But I guess I would say whip. Just how good of a season are you having? The you know, whip to me is the one. And the closer to 1.0 you are, the better. Like, you're not going to be under one probably as a starter unless you're vying for a Cy Young Award or something. But that's one that to me, how many base runners are you allowing each inning? You know, that because that tells you about walks, batting average against, right? There's a lot of things involved there. The ERA, I think, could be an easy one you could say too. But I think oftentimes if you look at, we're getting a little nerdy here, but like FIP is fielding independent pitching. That's basically the part of like what your ERA should be based on how you've thrown, taking a bunch of factors into account and taking things you didn't control out of the equation. And a lot of times it could be a half run or a run different than your ERA. You know, you could have pitched in luck or pitched in bad luck, which is why with whip, I think sometimes, you know, you see someone with like a 1.07, you're like, oh, this guy's having a hell of a year. Whereas if it's 1.38, you go, okay, you're going to get a lot of chances against this guy because he's constantly got base runners on.
Yeah, I think I would go with whip as well, because we're still talking about traditional stats in that sense. OPS is more of a traditional. It's more advanced than what it used to be, but it's not like we're getting into expected batting average. We're not getting into StatCast stuff. OPS is pretty straightforward, whereas whip is also pretty straightforward. We could get into like XERA and all those things, but I kind of like whip because it can kind of tell you maybe this guy's pitching a little bit lucky this year. Like, we talked about what JoJo did last year, and he was obviously deserving of an all-star. But you look at his ERA last year, 3.91. You look at his whip, a 1.45 or 1.46. It's like it doesn't quite match, right? So you can see that, okay, there was a little bit of luck in there, or maybe we're going to see him regress back a little bit and he's going to have that ERA jump up a little bit. It basically is just telling you how many dudes are on base. Obviously, the more dudes on base each inning, the more runs you're going to give up in general. So I think that's a pretty simple one just to kind of tell you, you know, obviously dudes can pitch out of jams and they can pitch a little bit lucky, but I do think whip would probably be that side on the pitching side.
And real quick, he's another one too. When you're talking about ERA versus whip, or excuse me, a FIP, fielding independent pitching. So like, why is ERA not the answer for me? Well, last year JoJo had a 3.9 ERA, but his fielding independent pitching was 4.9. That basically the ERA was 3.91 and the ERA should have been 4.93, a full run higher. If you know, he didn't pitch in some decent luck or sometimes create his own luck by getting out of a bunch of jams, which, you know, you get credit for, but I digress.
Yeah. And just to continue on about whip real quick, look at Jake Irvin's season from last year to this year. Jake Irvin last year in 24 starts had a whip of 1.42, whereas this year so far through 13 starts a 1.03. That's an impressive drop in whip, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. And it's a walks. It's a big thing in the walks. We've talked about this before. He's limited the walks, and in turn, you limit the base runners. In turn, that one base hit you get up in an inning, that's not a run scored anymore. So I think that's an easy way to point out, like, the big difference for Jake Irvin, less base runners this year. In turn, better ERA, better pitcher.
Also, that whip of barely over one, I mean, that is really strong. Like, you know, Max Scherzer would lead the league in whip annually here at 0.97, you know, 0.92. When he was flirting with no hitters every time out and pitching the ERAs in the low twos, he had 0.9 plus, right? But again, that's Cy Young caliber. That's what relievers do. That's what Finnegan's going to have, that kind of a whip. For a starter to be down around one, anything really under 1.1, I think is fantastic. So that's just indicative of the year he's having.
Love to see it. Jack Swellington on Twitter says, everyone is crediting Sean Doolittle with the Nats' unexpected rotation renaissance. How much blame does Darnell Cole shoulder for a team with the third worst OPS in the MLB? Do we need a batting version of Doolittle, or is it just that we don't have very many good hitters?
I wouldn't say that it's they don't have very good hitters. It's they don't have a lot of power hitters. When you look at K-Bert Ruiz, we were excited because he had a career year last year in home runs. He had 18. He didn't get to 20, right? You look at C.J. Abrams, I think he provides some power. But what's CJ's ceiling in terms of power? 25, 30 home runs. Joey Gallo hasn't provided a whole lot there. Luis Garcia has some pop, but again, we're talking maybe a 20 homer guy. Meneses, we've seen he's not a homer guy. Senzel, throughout his career, not a homer guy. Rosario's had some home runs. Lane Thomas had 28 last year. Winker's had a few. And then obviously Jay Wise, not really a home run guy. Just up and down the lineup, they're not generally a team that has a lot of pop. And I don't know if that's just an organizational thing. You know, when you've got guys coming down the pipeline, you know, I think Brady House has a lot of power. Yo-Yo has a lot of power. James Wood obviously has a ton of power. And Dylan Cruz can probably give you 20, 25 home runs. So I think power will come in the future. I don't know, you know, if we're just talking about the lower OPS, I think it goes to the talent on the roster, not necessarily Darnell Coles. If you want to talk about sometimes the approach, because I think if you look back to the Mets series, you look at certain things, sometimes the approach is a little bit questionable. I think that would go to Darnell Coles. Maybe you could find someone that if you brought in a different hitting coach could get them a little bit more power or change things a little bit. I'm not to say that I'm the biggest Darnell Coles fan, but I think when you're just asking that simple question about the OPS, I think it's more players than Coles.
I think that, yeah, their roster construction's the bigger issue, in my opinion, in that it's too hard to mount a bunch of hits and walks together to score runs. Like what they did in their 7-run inning today, which was one of the craziest innings they've had as we tape on Sunday. This was game 4 of the Braves series. So in the 5th inning, they had 5 hits and 7 runs. Abrams flies out to right. Thomas singles. Winker walks. Rosario flies out. So there's a runner at first with 2 down. Then they strung together a Luis Garcia base hit. Ruiz 3-run homer. Senzel walk. Gallo single. Young walk. Abrams a 3-run double. Like that just doesn't happen. It's too hard to do that. It's literally the second time it's happened all year. When you don't hit home runs, it's just hard to be good offensively, period. And they don't have power. And the couple of guys they have that they think should hit for power, A, aren't really good hitters, see Joey Gallo, and B, aren't really doing it. So that's why they're not very good offensively. Having said that, he asked, do they need a Doolittle on the hitting side? Absolutely. Good coaches, you need those. You know, like to me, the brilliance of Doolittle is that he is the conduit between Hickey, who's a little more old school. That's the perception on the outside. And my conversations with him have led me to believe those perceptions are correct, frankly. And like the analytics community, which Doolittle is a card carrying member of. And the beauty is that he played. And so when he says it, it's okay. You know, when a guy like me says something, you're just a nerd who didn't play. When Doolittle says the same thing, you're brilliant. And I'm not I'm not pretending to be some analytical guy or as smart as Sean Doolittle, but like the perception matters, right? Like players care about what players think. So yeah, it would be great to have a recent hitter. Daniel Murphy was unbelievably analytical and intuitive. Someone like that who could be like a swing doctor on their staff. I think it would help a lot. I don't know enough about Coles, frankly, to have a real big, strong opinion in terms of how much he's mattered, good, bad, and different. Am I impressed? No, it's why would I be impressed? I mean, their offense hasn't been consistent or that good for a long time. But I also think, you know, they're giving him there's no resources. They don't spend money. Power costs money. Big time bats cost money and they don't spend it.
Yeah, and I think, too, like, if you look at it, you know, some guys, a lot of them do work in the offseason away from the team, and you look at the change in C.J. Abrams, and, you know, MLB Network has been kind of all over his season so far, and it's the difference in the pull percentage and these various things. So I think with hitters sometimes, too, they can kind of work with dudes outside the organization. We've talked about this before with, you know, Darnell Coles and people wanting him to fire it. It's like sometimes you talk to people and it's like, oh, the hitting coach is important. Sometimes you talk to people and the hitting coach is just kind of there, right? He helps you out a little bit, grabs a video and gives you a word of advice here or there, but they're working with other guys. So I think you're right. It would be probably nice to have a guy, a former national or just a former player in general around the club like a Doolittle. I think any ball club, doesn't matter who it is, Dodgers, Yankees, obviously the Nationals or the O's, whatever, they would all love to have a former player that succeeded like a Doolittle around the organization to help out and be the conduit between a, you know, a coach and the players. But I don't know who that would be, but yeah, I think that would be a good thing. But just, you know, again, wrapping it up, I think for me, and it's just more so that the players aren't OPS guys, high OPS guys, and Darnell Coles isn't necessarily helping them with it, but that's probably more so than Cole's.
Yeah, real quick. I mean, you got Winker for Senzel for $2 million, $3 million. He was like your biggest splash before Gallo was a $5 million guy that was
deferred.
You know, nobody was nobody was calling. Rosario was available in spring training. You know, so let's not pretend like they went on some shopping spree and guys are underachieving, really. Yeah.
Yeah, and it kind of seems like Darnell Coles has just kind of become a little bit of an easy way to blame somebody. Seems like it really came from a viral clip that came from something on Nationals Twitter, I'm pretty sure, where CJ had hit about a 400-foot out straight to center field at Nats Park, and he came back to the dugout and said that he should have pulled it. And you can hear in the background in this clip, Darnell Coles basically said, "Pull it? Why would you pull it?" And it seems like everybody's taking that clip. I don't know if it's out of context or they've just taken it to the next level where they're using that as a reason to blame Darnell Coles for not encouraging CJ to pull the ball more.
Yeah, I thought that was so stupid when I saw that. Not that what Cole said, but that everyone was mad about it. Like the correct approach is to go back up the middle and to hit the ball up the middle. Also, people have no idea what the conversation they were having is.
It's about a 10-second clip. It's so out of context, and I don't know how people can find themselves mad.
Well, okay, I'll give you an example. We're at the game on Sunday. CJ Abrams pulls a ball that's a curveball down and away, and it's just a ground out to second base. If you wanted to pull the ball every time, including pitches off the plate away, then he's just going to ground out a lot more. Not to say that he shouldn't pull the ball, not to say that he shouldn't, but there are more advanced approaches than just saying pull every baseball that you see.
Yeah, but it's not even the correct approach to default to pull the baseball. Correct. Like that's not how hitters hit. Everything about that dialogue I thought was the dumbest thing I'd seen in a long time. I did not engage in it. It made no sense to me. Also, no one had, like, I didn't even see, did we know what the pitch location, where the pitch was? Like, none of that made any sense.
I like getting Grant a little fired up. Steven Newman on Twitter says, who's the most likely internal option to be the 2025 opening day first baseman? And how aggressive should we expect them to be towards adding a big name free agent at first base in 2025?
That's a great question by Steven. Because as I think about this, I don't think there is a good option. No. And like among their internal options, he said, starting at first base. Okay, so that means, just thinking out loud, Meneses is probably going to be gone, I would think. But hypothetically, it could be him. Gallo's not under contract. I guess theoretically, they could bring him back. That's not happening. Yoandy Morales is the one guy, you know, high minors right now who plays first that he's not hitting nearly well enough in Double A that you'd project him to be on the opening day roster next year. There's not really anyone else at the major league level. So now you start to get cute and you say, okay, if Riley Adams, who doesn't really play first, they send him down to get some reps in the minor leagues. Like if he killed it in spring training next year and played first well, could he be the guy? Again, now we have to answer with someone on the roster. Could they have Lipscomb at second and maybe play Luis Garcia at first base? I'm just trying to make something up at this point. Those are some things coming to mind.
The answer might be Juan Yepes, if that gets you fired up. He has a 774 OPS this year at AAA, and he plays first base. So that might be your answer, Juan Yepes. I don't know that that inspires a lot of enthusiasm, but
it does not. No.
that might be your option.
How about Jesse Winker? Back on like a 1 or 2 year deal playing first base.
I'd welcome that.
Next year. You know, when you've got Wood in the big leagues, Cruz coming, Hassel knocking on the door, Lane Thomas, Jacob Young, you don't need him in the outfield. Ideally, you flipped him and traded him for something. Maybe he's back at that point on a 1 or 2 year deal. But I say all this to say, and I think this is why it's a good question from Steven. The other part of his question was essentially how aggressive will they be? This is where they've got to sign a bat. You know, one of the big things they've got to do this offseason is go out. I'd like to see them add a veteran starting pitcher to help slot everybody down in the rotation. You need more than 5 or 6 or even 7 probably to get through the year, and we're seeing the organizational depth improve. But the other thing is they need a bat who can hit home runs, and that it will cost money. But, you know, whether or not they spend it this offseason, I'm very skeptical and dubious. I'm not sure. This should be the offseason where they at least throw some money at a problem. And I think first base makes the most sense by far with all the outfielders they've got coming. And then with the young infielders they've got, with Lipscomb and Garcia and Abrams, and you know, enough there that you would say House as well knocking on the door. Like there's not really anybody at first that you'd be blocking.
Well, and what's interesting, Grant, is if you would have told me going into the offseason before the year, like going into next offseason, say, if you want them to spend money on something, what would it be? I would have said starting pitching, and then maybe number two would have been first base. But with the way that some of these guys have emerged, I don't know that starting pitching is as big of a need. I think they'd still maybe want a frontline guy if they're going to open up the checkbooks. But yeah, first base is probably the place that you're going to spend it. And so, yeah, I think that they need to make a move there because of the guys internally. It's just not... it's not very inspiring. And I'll say this, you know, Lipscomb's played over there a little bit, but it's clearly not his position that he's comfortable at. If they wanted to try to transition him over there and just make that his full-time position, that's one thing, and that's fine. It's also something too, where I really like Lipscomb, but he doesn't hit well enough to be just a first baseman all the time. When you've got guys coming down the pike, I think he maybe is going to be the utility guy when you've got all these guys up there. So maybe you want to teach him first base and he starts there next year, but
I'll tell you this. I mean, he probably hits well enough to be there in a bad lineup, you know, which sure. is what they have now and they might have next year. And he's not going to hit for less power than Meneses, and he's not going to be less productive than sure. Meneses, right? You know, so like, yeah, I'm with you. Like, everything you said's correct, but it's worse right now. So yeah. Like, we have literally seen this ownership group, this front office do something worse, probably not by choice in the front office's case.
Yeah, that's a great question by Steven, because the answer is we don't know, which obviously shows that it's a good question.
Just to add on here, so the upcoming unrestricted free agent first baseman in 2025, Paul Goldschmidt, Pete Alonso, Josh Bell, Christian Walker, Joey Votto, Carlos Santana, any of those names interest you?
Run through them again real quick.
Paul Goldschmidt, Pete Alonso, Josh Bell, Christian Walker, Joey Votto, Carlos Santana. Those are your top seven.
Most realistically, Christian Walker probably. Obviously, Pete Alonso, would be amazing. If go get a 40-homer bat, you'd have to pay a ton of money, bring him over, weaken the Mets. I would sign up for that sight unseen. But I don't think that's realistic. I don't think they're spending that kind of money next offseason.
Yeah, I'd love a Josh Bell. But again, who knows? If they're not even going to pay Joey Gallo $5 million in 1 year, then...
I will say that they got to start spending more money next offseason, right?
100%.
Like at some point, they got to put their spending cap on. But Bell, you know, he's 31 now. He was bad defensively. Well, bad might be strong, but he was not great defensively when he was here before. Last time I saw him, you know, not my job to poke at the guy, but he was a little bit bigger than he was when he played here. I'm a Josh Bell mark. I love the guy, but I kind of would prefer him as a DH, and it's not like he's having a great offensive year on a terrible team with Miami anyway.
Yo, it's Jay Uso from WWE,
and I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer, SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino
and enter for your chance to win.
Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus.
I'm going to combine a couple of questions here from Chris in Hyattsville and The Real McCoy VT. They both are basically asking, who is the top option in the draft at number 10 for the Washington Nationals this coming draft, which is in July?
Yes, it's at All-Star festivities out in Texas. In fact, I'll be there, so we'll have great coverage for BLB live from Globe Life in Texas and throughout the draft process. So they picked 10th for people that don't know, as Darius mentioned. This draft is the most college-heavy top of the draft, I think, probably of any draft I've covered. I've been covering drafts now. This will be my 17th year doing this for MLB Network Radio. There's a really good chance that there is one or two high schoolers taken, maybe in the top 12 or 13 picks, which is extremely abnormal. There's a kid named Bryce Rayner, a shortstop from Harvard-Westlake in California, which is the same school that Lucas Giolito and Max Fried and Jack Flaherty and so many others have gone to. And then there's another kid from Mississippi at Jackson Prep named Connor Griffin, Both of those guys are 18 years old. Griffin's a big right-handed bat who can play some short and outfield. Rayner is a left-handed hitter who, at 18 years old, is tooled up as well and has a chance to be a really, really good player. They've been mocked to the Nats in quite a few mock drafts because of the fact that they're going to go somewhere in the back end of the top 10 or like the early, you know, 11 to 14 range. I just think the Nats, after going so college heavy last year, will do the same in this college heavy class. So a bunch of the stars that most people know will be gone. Jack Caglione, the two-way superstar to Florida. Charlie Condon might go 1-1 out of Georgia to the Guardians. Travis Bazzana, the second baseman at Oregon State, one of the best hitters in the country. Those types of guys might be gone. I think the Nats will circle in on a college pitcher, perhaps, if I had to guess. And if they go that route, I mean, the dream for me would be that somebody like Chase Burns falls somehow into their lap out of Wake Forest, a righty who can touch 100. I think he'll probably be gone. Hagen Smith, the lefty at Arkansas, possibly as well. So I'll say somebody like, just go off the board a little bit. Let's say that they take Brody Brecht. It might be a little early. Most mocks are going to have him in the mid first round, but an Iowa right-hander, you know, fastball, breaking ball, kind of on the level of a Skeens. The difference being he's just not nearly as good a pitcher, not nearly as deep a repertoire, and he might end up a reliever because he had some control problems at different points this season. But huge, huge ceiling. I'd go college arm if I was the Nats.
Yeah, I think they will want to go college arm. I mean, you got Chase Burns, Hagen Smith, some of the guys you mentioned. I think that's probably at the top of their list. If those guys are gone and they don't maybe want to reach on a guy, maybe a Nick Kurtz falls. If he's not there, maybe it's a Weatherholt. Like, I think that they're going to go college. Now, maybe they, you know, if they just think that they one of these high schoolers is the best guy. And I think what happened last year where you have the success of these guys early, obviously Sakura is a high schooler, but you think Pinckney, you think Yo-Yo, obviously Dylan Cruz, even some of the other guys like a Gavin Dugas, that's a college guy. I think they're going to want to go college, but I do think it's interesting, Grant, because last year's draft personnel, the guys in charge of it are not necessarily the same as this year's, aside from Mike Rizzo. So Rizzo is going to have his thing. He's going to be building off the success of last year, but you're bringing over a Danny Haas and some of these other guys. So I'm interested to see their approach. If I had to bet, if we're doing it, I would go with a college and I would think college arm. If it's not a college arm, maybe a college bat. But I think there's also the possibility they go with a high school bat. So I think it could go anywhere. That's what happens when you're picking 10th, which they shouldn't be picking. They should be picking earlier. But let's just hope one of these college arms falls to them and they end up with a stud.
Yeah, and Nick Kurtz, who you mentioned, would be really interesting as both a like a nice player and also a guy who could move really quickly. He is a left-handed hitting first baseman, massive guy, 6'5", 240, with huge power, and a guy that has a good eye at the plate, led all of Division I with 75 walks. So just a nice player, top five in the class probably. Chance he's gone before 10. But would certainly be a fit for the Nationals.
Matt O'Neill on Twitter says, with multiple young outfielders developing in the minors, what is the future of Lane Thomas? Does he stay with the team until the end of 2025, which is the last year he has team control, or the team has control over him? Or do they attempt to move him this year and bring up Woods to finish the season?
Yeah, it's intriguing with Thomas because, you know, theoretically, he's been a really solid player, but I don't know that he's a part of the long-term future of this team. And when you start looking at team control, maybe you do end up trying to move him. I don't think it's going to be this year, Grant. I don't think, you know, that's something we talked about going into the deadline last year. I don't think they're going to do it this year, but I would not be surprised in the offseason because, you know, a Hassel's coming down the pipeline. Obviously, a James Wood. Dylan Cruz has picked things up to the point that it wouldn't surprise us if by the All-Star break he's up at AAA and then he's knocking on the door of the big leagues. And if that's the case, that's three outfielders we named right there, not including some of the other guys that can play out there. So I'm intrigued by those guys coming up. I don't know what the long-term plans are for Lane. I would expect that he's going to be with them the rest of this year, but I would think that maybe in the offseason, because it'd be going into that last year of control, they maybe look to move him then. But he's also a good veteran to keep around to help teach the guys.
Yeah, I think it also probably matters, like, how is he playing? You know, right now, he's a way better player than his numbers would suggest. which isn't to say that teams don't know that, but to trade like a guy, Lane Thomas has a negative war right now, like 0.2 in the negative. Well, he's a super helpful player. He's a tremendous defensive player, really good with outfield assists. He's stolen 15 bases in 18 tries, and he's a good offensive player as well. Now, he hasn't hit like it because before he got hurt this year, it was a struggle, and his ops plus is 81. That's a stat you'll hear us drop as well. We were talking about OPS earlier. Ops plus is just to me, it's super simple and fun. Like, the average player in the big leagues is a 100 ops plus. So anything below that is below average. Anything above that is above average. And it's by the percentage, you know, difference. So he's 81 ops plus. He's 19% below average this year offensively, which is crazy to think about. But that's not indicative of what Lane Thomas is. And I just say that to tell you that I wouldn't trade him right now. And if he doesn't have a good finish to the season, you know, he goes into the offseason with an 80 ops plus, I ain't trading him then either, because he's not he's worth way more to me than he would be, you know, in the open market, as an example. Well, it's a good problem to have, though. And also, you do not want just three kids in the outfield. Like that sounds cool. And in a video game, it might be a good thing. Eventually Cruz and Wood are going to be side by side, and they're not normal, you know, prospects. So that's fine. And there's going to be plenty of days and maybe even regular days where Jacob Young is out there with those guys or whatever. In a perfect world, Young might be your fourth guy who gets to play a bunch, spelling guys, but Wood and Cruz and a Thomas might be, you know, the outfield, or maybe, God forbid, they've actually spent some money and gone and gotten like a 35 homer, you know, big league bat in the corner. And then you have Cruz in center and Wood in left or right, depending on what you want to do. Like, James can play center field really, really well. I just don't love the idea of him being your center fielder because of the wear and tear on a big guy's body. Aaron Judge is a really good center fielder defensively. There's a reason why the Yankees don't ask him and don't want him to be in center field all the time.
Well, and just real quick, too, since Lane Thomas has come back from his injury May 27th, doesn't include today's stats, but 13 games, he's been much better. 275 average, 333 on base, 490 slug, 824 ops. So he's been much more like the player we've expected since he's come back from the injury. If he keeps that up, those numbers are going to even out.
And he's so good with the outfield assist as well. When he guns a runner down, he's done it a couple times in this past homestand. It's awesome to watch. This name is funny because if you just look at his at, it's Brian and then a bunch of numbers. But his actual name on Twitter says Brian, comma, a real person. So I want to shout out Brian, a real person, because I think that's funny. His question is, any chance Corbin moves to the bullpen? If successful, would he draw any interest if salary retained?
Yes to the first question. And again, they're skipping his start this week, so you could tell where he's at in the grand scheme of things. Very little, I would imagine. I mean, if he throws really well, first of all, a lot of dominoes would have to fall into place. He'd have to get to the bullpen, show well over a few weeks in a row. And at that point, maybe a team would be interesting in him as a one or two inning lefty or something like that. But you're just not getting much back for him, even if you eat salary.
Yeah, and real quick off of that too, you know, if you're wondering what's going to happen when you get into a roster crunch, you obviously look at the starting pitching and think of guys in the rotation. But if Corbin were to move to the bullpen, which I think would make sense at some point, they've got some expendable guys like Tanner Rainey. I don't know how long he's going to be here. As we're talking here on Sunday, Jordan Weems has really struggled, so I don't know if he's going to be in the bullpen much longer. They could move on from one of those guys and move Corbin to the pen, and then that gives you a spot in the rotation to, you know, take Patrick Corbin's spot there.
At Kirk's Kicks on Twitter says, could Darris finish the 9-beer, 9-glizzy challenge at a Nats day game?
Well, that's on to you, Darris. Could you do it?
First of all, this is one of my buddies, and I hate him for doing this, for saying this. Love you, Kirk. 9-beer, 9-glizzy challenge. That's absolutely impossible. There's no way I could do that.
Has anybody successfully done this without dying?
There's no way.
I agree. Right?
Okay, if you can't do it, Darris,
is that saying a beer and a hot dog per inning?
Every inning. You're supposed to eat a hot dog with a bun. But you could do whatever you want. So you could like roll up the bun into a ball and just bite at it.
No way.
You could cut the hot dog into pieces. You could Joey Chestnut this thing.
Well, here's the question then. If you can't go all nine, how far do you think you could go in a ball game?
I could maybe get, And what beer are we talking? Are we talking the tall boys? I feel like that's all that's at Nats Park. I don't see anything. There's nothing smaller than like the
tall. Well, I think a tall boy counts as two.
Okay. If I could probably do four. Four beers, four glizzies.
Come on, Darius. We can get you further than the fourth inning.
No, that's or crazy. So
I don't even think, like, ideally the pace has to be kept up to do it or whatever. But I think no matter when you do it, it counts. You just got to do nine over nine.
No, I think it's got to be in the inning.
I think I could do four over nine.
Patrick Corbin can go six innings, Darius can go six innings. Come on.
I think I could definitely eat five hot dogs. That's a given.
So I don't.
Yeah, but the heaviness of the beer combined with the hot dog is just too much.
And that's the thing. I mean, I hate beer. I'm a cocktail guy. I love bourbon. Liquor drinks is my preference. I don't do beer. I don't do wine really. So I'm out. I mean, I hate beer.
Yeah, I don't drink, so I couldn't do that part. But if you said I had to eat nine hot dogs, I could eat nine hot dogs. But obviously, I'm missing a big part of that.
Yeah. Yeah, if it was just the hot dogs, sure, but you combine it with the beer, that's just way.
You think you could eat nine hot dogs?
I think so.
Absolutely.
I think I could eat nine hot dogs.
I think that's way easier said than done. I tell you what, next time we go to, we should go as a show field trip. We'll promote it beforehand. I will pay either of you. If you finish nine hot dogs, I'll give you $50. but if you don't, you've got to give me $20.
I might be down for that.
We can work on the details on that at a later
and
time.
Buns. Yeah, and buns.
Yeah, that's going to be the difficult part is the buns part. There's someone.
No way. Nine hot dogs?
Someone, if you work in Nats concessions, can you please let me know where the smallest hot dogs are?
Yeah, it's got to be like a standard size hot dog. It can't be like the last time we went, Toby, and we got the – like the end of the game hot dogs. Those are big hot dogs. There's no way.
Oh no, I'm better off with that than like the foot long hot dogs they sell.
Yeah, you don't want one of those super long winners. You need the smaller ones. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. 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 Funny bit from Kirk's Kicks, but that's nine beers and nine glizzies is outrageous. Ryan Cox on Twitter says, do you see House, Cruz, and Wood all getting the call up earlier than September? And do you think Hassel III gets a look at the big league club this year as well?
No, not before September.
Mm-mm. No. I would think that Wood will get a look, but out of those guys, that's the only one. Now, I'm interested to see if those guys do get a look in September. Brady House been a little bit of a funk, so I don't know where he's going to be. I would think that if things continue the way they are, I would think that Cruz gets bumped up to AAA in the next month or so, and then we would see him in September. Hassel's intriguing because I don't know what they're going to wait on him, and maybe they do give him a shot, but I don't think it's before September. So to answer his question, before September, only Wood, but I would think that there's a chance we could see Hassel, maybe even over a Cruz.
Also, Hassel has not played over the last several days. I asked somebody with the organization what's going on. They said he should be fine. Didn't seem like they were worried, but they also wouldn't divulge much information as to what was going on. So keep an eye on box scores in Harrisburg to see if he gets back in the lineup here. Something's going on there. But I'd love to say we'll see all of them this year, and I definitely think we should. I think by the end of the year, September when the rosters expand, Hassel, House, Cruz, those guys should all debut. I'm going to say we obviously see James Wood sooner than later. I don't think he'll play this week in the minors, but probably the following week he'll be back. You will see Cruz in the big leagues in September. You should, but I would bet on that. And then I think we see Hassel. House, I'm not as sure about. He's probably considered maybe a little further away.
Yeah, it's always concerning when a minor league player in the Nats organization disappears for a few days because you just never know what that means. Alex, call me maybe. What a great name. We got some great names from people who listen to Bustin' Loose Baseball.
I wonder if this guy's fired up about Carly Rae Jepsen as a post-game concert later this
Probably
year.
Probably is. He's also fired up about Alex Call going 3-for-3 with a bolt today at AAA.
Love it.
Whoa.
Got his average up to like 210.
Let's go, Alex Call. With the young starters already in the rotation and a deeper pitching prospect pool than initially thought, can you see the Nats packaging someone like a Jackson Rutledge, Andrew Lara, Andrew Alvarez for a cost-controllable hitter this offseason?
I don't, because pitching costs so much money, right? So, like, I actually think it could go the other way, where they package a couple of outfielders for an arm, where they go do what the Orioles did, let's say, and get their Corbin Burns. You get a guy on a one-year, two-year deal. Now, they wouldn't do it this offseason on a one- or two-year deal, probably, because they're not ready to win, unless they think they could extend that guy. But I could see a situation where, I'm just making names up, but, like, they put Dalen Lyle and Trey Lipscomb and Travis Sakura, you know, in a package for, like, a legitimate, controllable starter for the next 3 years who comes over as, like, their number two or, like, a frontline-type starting pitcher. I think you would go that way. The things that cost the most money are starting pitching and home runs. And so that's what this team doesn't want to spend money. Those are the things you can't really trade.
Yeah, I think you hit it right there on the head. Like, I think more than likely, if they're going to package a couple prospects for something, it's going to be an arm. It's going to be an arm they control for a little while. And they've got a surplus of hitters in some spots, especially the outfield. So I think if they're going to do it, they're not going to package starting pitching because, well, one, I don't know what Jackson Rutledge is going to bring back. I'd be interested in Alara and some of those other guys. But I think that it's more likely they package a couple of bats for an arm.
Greg Steiger on Twitter says, will Barry's story in the Washington Post regarding the pettiness on the exit of Strasburg make free agents shy away from a learner-owned team?
I don't think so, no. Players care about money. And there are other things, too, right? Like, are the schools good? And where's my family going to live? And some other details that, you know, we don't know about, we're not privy to with each person's situation. But are you paying them the most of the other teams that are courting them? Then they're probably going to go to your place. For people that didn't read the Barry story, you should check it out. We'll talk more about it on the next pod. Didn't want to get into it too deep because of the lengthy mailbag here. But the gist is that, you know, Strasburg did a sit down with Sferluga, who's a terrific baseball writer for the Post. Kind of an exit interview as he's getting ready to move back out west from McLean. Among the other things that came up were that he was super disappointed, it seemed like, that a couple different times the Nats wrote him these letters making demands that he go rehab at a facility or show up for events they were having. They wanted him at the 2019 World Series celebration. They wanted him around the team in kind of as a veteran and a leader in the clubhouse. And he thought that was silly and that it wasn't something he should be doing because he wasn't going to pitch and he thought it was just for show. But he didn't like the fact specifically, I think, that at one point, even though he'd already told them and they understood he wasn't ever going to be able to pitch again, they wanted him to kind of keep rehabbing a leg injury at a facility every day and kind of keep showing up and essentially like punching a time card. And so clearly there's some issues between he and the team that are unresolved. But That stuff's personal. Like, players don't get into other players' business in that way, I don't think. And I don't think anyone's going to see that. I don't know that it's going to, like, make the rounds other than with Boris advised players because he's the agent who's probably mad about it. But even still, like, did it stop Scott Boris from, you know, bringing guys here this offseason? Is it going to stop him from, you know, whether it's James Wood or others from, like, them, you know, getting deals done after they draft? Absolutely not.
Well, and I think we're going to dive into that a little bit deeper on our next pod, like you said. But I think when you look at some of the other examples of players that wanted to be back here or wanted to stay here or love their time here, Adam LaRoche was recently on the radio broadcast with the guys and had said that he loved playing in Washington and it was his favorite team that he played for. And I know that's a little bit of a ways away from where we are now, but still, people love playing here. You think back, and I think Bryce Harper, even on a podcast after he'd signed with Philadelphia, had said he wanted to come back to Washington so much so that he'd even told people that maybe he wouldn't have minded a trade in 2018 and then re-signing with the team. And obviously Juan Soto, I think obviously some of the contract stuff there, but I think if you just ask Juan if everything was equal, if he would have wanted to stay in Washington, he would have said yes. So I don't think there's a huge issue with people wanting to play with the Nationals like we've seen with other organizations in this city. So I don't think that that's going to hugely affect people coming here. Like you said, Grant, it's pretty simple. If you're willing to pay the most money or, you know, maybe if it's close, like if this ball club is contending again, I think those sort of things factor in. Maybe if someone's a friend of Strauss or they've talked to Strauss, maybe he could sway them a little bit here or there. But I think in general, it's going to be about the money and whether the team is competing for a World Series or not, less about some of this extra stuff that, you know, Barry wrote about with Strauss.
All right, nice job, Darius. Thank you. That does it for our questions.
Yeah, that'll do it. There's believe me, there's plenty of more. You guys got a lot of responses to your tweets. So we appreciate everybody submitting questions for the mailbag. Well, maybe we'll do another one soon. We can also rattle off some of these at the end of some of the upcoming episodes. So keep listening for Bustin' Loose Baseball. You might hear one of your unheard questions from this podcast. Maybe you'll hear it at the back end of some upcoming episodes.
Love that. Go subscribe, rate, and review to Bustin' Loose Baseball. We do this before and after every single national series. Speaking of which, next up, the Detroit Tigers. And here's the good news. Toby, the Nats are going to miss Tarik Skubal, the stud lefty, who I don't think this was accurate, but supposedly touched 102 in his start today that might win the Cy Young in the American League. So the series is Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. 6:40 starts on Tuesday and Wednesday, and then a 1:10 game on Thursday afternoon. And then the Nats are back home Friday through Sunday over Father's Day weekend to take on the Marlins.
And don't miss it. Friday, I believe, is a bobblehead day for one Mike Rizzo. That's an interesting one. I wonder how many teams are giving away general manager bobbleheads. I kind of like it, though. I think Rizzo deserves one. He's awesome.
Yeah, Rizzo has been around for now, going back to, I think, what, 2012 as the general manager? Memory serves. I think he took over maybe in the 2011 season, something like that. So well over a decade for Rizzo, one of the longest tenured execs in baseball, and obviously a World Series champion.
Have you seen the commercial that's running for that, by the way, where Rizzo's running around the offices saying, "Hey, guys, I got my first bobblehead. What do you think?" Yeah, it's a great commercial, great material.
It's fantastic.
Yeah. Rizzo Zimmerman sitting at the desk, employee number 11. Four, Darius Dameron, Toby Altizer. I'm Grant Paulson saying so long. Thanks for listening to BLB. We'll be back after the Detroit series.